Susanna no longer thought she was just trying to kill time. This information might come in handy later on. And after the king's men, Pear's low men, have scooped the kid's brains, what then? Back through the door with them, I suppose, the one under the castle. Back to the wolves' staging point, and a train takes them the rest of the way home. Aye. Why do they bother taking him back at all? Lady, I know not. Then Mia's voice dropped. There's another door under Castle Discordia. Another door in the rooms of ruin. One that goes, she licked her lips, that goes Todash. Todash? I know the word, but I don't understand what's so bad. There are endless worlds. Your din is correct about that. But even when those worlds are close together, like some of the multiple New Yorks, there are endless spaces between. Think you of the spaces between the inner and outer walls of a house. Places where it's always dark. But just because a place is always dark doesn't mean it's empty. Does it, Susanna? There are monsters in the Todash darkness. Who had said that, Roland? She couldn't remember for sure, and what did it matter? She thought she understood what Mia was saying, and if so, it was horrible. Rats in the walls, Susanna. Bats in the walls. All sorts of sucking, biting bugs in the walls. Stop it, I get the picture. That door beneath the castle, one of their mistakes, I have no doubt, goes to nowhere at all. Into the darkness between worlds, Todash space. But not empty space. Her voice lowered further. That door is reserved for the Red King's most bitter enemies. They're thrown into a darkness where they may exist, blind, wandering, insane for years, but in the end, something always finds them and devours them. Monsters beyond the ability of such minds as ours to bear thought of. Susanna found herself trying to picture such a door, and what waited behind it. She didn't want to, but couldn't help it. Her mouth dried up. In that same low and somehow horrible tone of confidentiality, Mia said, "There were many places where the old people tried to join magic and science together, but Jan may be the only one left." She nodded toward the Dogon. "It was there that Walter took me, to make me mortal, and take me out of Prim's way forever. To make me like you." 13. Mia didn't know everything, but so far as Susanna could make out, Walter, Flag, had offered the spirit, later to be known as Mia, the avatar of Faustian bargains. If she was willing to give up her nearly eternal but discorporate state and become a mortal woman, then she could become pregnant and bear a child. Walter was honest with her about how little she would actually be getting for all she'd be giving up. The baby wouldn't grow as normal babies did, as baby Michael had done before Mia's unseen but worshipful eyes. And she might only have him for 7 years, but oh, what wonderful years they could be. Beyond this, Walter had been tactfully silent, allowing Mia to form her own pictures. How she would nurse her baby and wash him, not neglecting the tender creases behind the knees and ears. How she would kiss him in the honey spot between the unfledged wings of his shoulder blades. How she would walk with him, holding both of his hands and both of hers as he toddled. How she would read to him and point out old star and old mother in the sky and tell him the story of how Rusty Sam stole the widow's best loaf of bread. How she would hug him to her and bathe his cheek with her grateful tears when he spoke his first word, which would, of course, be Mama. Susanna listened to this rapturous account with a mixture of pity and cynicism. Certainly Walter had done one hell of a job selling the idea to her, and as ever, the best way to do that was to let the mark sell herself. He'd even proposed a properly satanic period of proprietorship, 7 years. "Just sign on the dotted line, madam, and please don't mind that whiff of brimstone. I just can't seem to get the smell out of my clothes." Susanna understood the deal and still had trouble swallowing it. This creature had given up immortality for morning sickness, swollen and achy breasts, and, in the last 6 weeks of her carry, the need to pee approximately every 15 minutes. And wait, folks, there's more. 2.5 years of changing diapers soaked with piss and loaded with shit. Of getting up in the night as the kid howls with the pain of cutting his first tooth. And cheer up, Mom, only 31 to go. That first magic spit-up. That first heartwarming spray of urine across the bridge of your nose when the kid lets go as you're changing his clout. And yes, there would be magic. Even though she'd never had a child herself, Susanna knew there would be magic even in the dirty diapers and the colic if the child were the result of a loving union. But to have the child and then have him taken away from you just when it was getting good, just as the child approached what most people agreed was the age of reason, responsibility and accountability, to then be swept over the Crimson King's red horizon, that was an awful idea. And was Mia so besotted by her impending motherhood that she didn't realize the little she had been promised was now being whittled away? Walter Flagg had come to her in Fedic, scenic aftermath of the Red Death, and promised her 7 years with her son. On the telephone in the Plaza Park, however, Richard Sayre had spoken of a mere 5. In any case, Mia had agreed to the dark man's terms. And really, how much sport could there have been in getting her to do that? She'd been made for motherhood, had arisen from the prim with that imperative, had known it herself ever since seeing her first perfect human baby, the boy Michael. How could she have said no? Even if the offer had only been for 3 years, or for one, how? Might as well expect a long-time junkie to refuse a loaded spike when it was offered. Mia had been taken into the Arc 16 experimental station. She'd been given a tour by the smiling, sarcastic, and undoubtedly frightening Walter, who sometimes called himself Walter of Endworld and sometimes Walter of Allworld. She'd seen the great room filled with beds awaiting the children who would come to fill them. At the head of each was a stainless steel hood attached to a segmented steel hose. She did not like to think what the purpose of such equipment might be. She'd also been shown some of the passages under the castle on the abyss, and had been in places where the smell of death was strong and suffocating. There had been a red darkness, and she— Were you mortal by then? Susanna asked. It sounds as though maybe you were.
I was on my way, she said. It was a process Walter called becoming.
All right. Go on. But here, Mia's recollections were lost in a dark fugue, not Todash, but far from pleasant. A kind of amnesia, and it was red. A color Susanna had come to distrust. Had the pregnant woman's transition from the world of the spirit to the world of the flesh, her trip to Mia, been accomplished through some other kind of doorway? She herself didn't seem to know. Only that there had been a time of darkness, unconsciousness, she supposed. And then she had awakened.
As you see me. Only not yet pregnant, of course.
According to Walter, Mia could not actually make a baby, even as a mortal woman. Carry, yes. Conceive, no. So it came to pass that one of the demon elementals had done a great service for the Crimson King, taking Roland's seed as female and passing it on to Susanna as male. And there had been another reason as well. Walter hadn't mentioned it, but Mia had known.
It's the prophecy, she said,
looking into Fedic's deserted and shadowless street. Across the way, a robot that looked like Andy of the Kala stood silent and rusting in front of the Fedic Café, which promised good meals cheap.
What prophecy? Susanna asked.
He who ends the line of Eld shall conceive a child of incest with his sister or his daughter, and the child will be marked. By his red heel shall you know him. It is he who shall stop the breath of the last warrior.
Woman, I'm not Roland's sister or his daughter either. You maybe didn't notice a small but basic difference in the color of our hides, namely his being white and mine being black.
But she thought she had a pretty good idea of what the prophecy meant just the same. Families were made in many ways. Blood was only one of them.
Did he not tell you what Din means?
Mia asked.
Of course it means leader. If he was in charge of a whole country instead of just three scruffy-ass gun puppies, it'd mean king.
Leader and king, you say true. Now, Susanna, would you tell me that such words aren't just poor substitutes for another?
Susanna made no reply. Mia nodded as though she had, then winced when a fresh contraction struck. It passed, and she went on.
The sperm was Roland's. I believe it may have been preserved somehow by the old people's science while the demon elemental turned itself inside out and made man from woman. But that isn't the important part. The important part is that it lived and found the rest of itself as ordained by Ka.
My egg. Your egg.
When I was raped in the Ring of Stones.
Say true.
Susanna sat musing. Finally she looked up. Seemed to me that it's what I said before. You didn't like it then, not apt to like it now, but, girl, you just the babysitter.
There was no rage this time. Mia only smiled.
Who went on having her periods even when she was being sick in the mornings? You did. And who's got the full belly today? I do. If there was a babysitter, Susanna of New York, it was you.
How can that be? Do you know?
Mia did.
14. The baby, Walter had told her, would be transmitted to Mia, sent to her cell by cell, just as a fax is sent line by line. Susanna opened her mouth to say she didn't know what a fax was, then closed it again. She understood the gist of what Mia was saying, and that was enough to fill her with a terrible combination of awe and rage. She had been pregnant. She was, in a real sense, pregnant right this minute. But the baby was being faxed, sent to Mia. Was this a process that had started fast and slowed down, or started slow and speeded up? The latter, she thought, because as time passed, she'd felt less pregnant instead of more. The little swelling in her belly had mostly flattened out again, and now she understood how both she and Mia could feel an equal attachment to the chap. It did, in fact, belong to both of them. Had been passed on like a blood transfusion. Only when they want to take your blood and put it into someone else, they ask your permission. If they're doctors, that is, and not one of Per Callahan's vampires. You're a lot closer to one of those, Mia, aren't you?
Science or magic? Susanna asked. Which one was it that allowed you to steal my baby?
Mia flushed a little at that, but when she turned to Susanna, she was able to meet Susanna's eyes squarely.
I don't know, she said. Likely a mixture of both. And don't be so self-righteous. It's in me, not you. It's feeding off my bones and my blood, not yours.
So what? Do you think that changes anything? You stole it with the help of some filthy magician. Mia shook her head vehemently, her hair a storm around her face.
No? Susanna asked. Then how come you weren't the one eating frogs out of the swamp and shoats out of the pen and God knows what other nasty things? How come you needed all that make-believe nonsense about the banquets in the castle where you could pretend to be the one eating, in short, sugar pie? How come your chap's nourishment had to go down my throat?
Because...
Mia's eyes, Susanna saw, were filling with tears. Because this is spoiled land, blasted land, the place of the Red Death and the edge of the Discordia. I'd not feed my chap from here.
It was a good answer, Susanna reckoned. But not the complete answer. And Mia knew it, too, because baby Michael, perfect baby Michael, had been conceived here, had thrived here, had been thriving when Mia last saw him. And if she was so sure, why were those tears standing in her eyes?
Mia, they're lying to you about your chap. You don't know that, so don't be hateful.
I do know it. And she did. But there wasn't proof, goddammit. How did you prove a feeling, even one as strong as this?
Flag, Walter, if you like that better, he promised you 7 years. Sarah says you can have 5. What if they hand you a card Good for 3 years of child-rearing with stamp when you get to this Dixie pig. Gonna go with that, too?
That won't happen. You're as nasty as the other one. Shut up.
You got a nerve calling me nasty. Can't wait to give birth to a child supposed to murder his daddy.
I don't care.
You're all confused, girl, between what you want to happen and what will happen. How do you know they aren't going to kill him before he can cry out his first breath and grind him up and feed him to these breaker bastards?
Shut up!
Kind of a superfood? Finish the job all at once?
Shut up, I said, shut up!
Point is, you don't know. You don't know anything. You just the babysitter, just the au pair. You know they lie. You know they trick and never treat, and yet you go on, and you want me to shut up.
Yes, yes!
I won't, Susanna told her grimly, and seized Mia's shoulders. They were amazingly bony under the dress, but hot as if the woman were running a fever. I won't because it's really mine, and you know it. Cat can have kittens in the oven, girl, but that won't ever make 'em muffins. All right, they had made it back to all-out fury after all. Mia's face twisted into something both horrible and unhappy. In Mia's eyes, Susanna thought she could see the endless, craving, grieving creature this woman once had been. And something else. A spark that might be blown into belief, if there was time.
I'll shut you up, Mia said,
and suddenly, FedEx Main Street tore open, just as the allure had. Behind it was a kind of bulging darkness, but not empty. Oh, no, not empty. Susanna felt that very clearly. They fell toward it. Mia propelled them toward it. Susanna tried to hold them back with no success at all. As they tumbled into the dark, she heard a sing-song thought running through her head, running in an endless worry circle. Oh, Susanna Mio, divided girl of mine, done parked her rig. 15. In the Dixie Pig, in the year of... Before this annoying but ever so important jingle could finish its latest circuit through Susanna Mio's head, the head in question struck something, and hard enough to send a galaxy of bright stars exploding across her field of vision. When they cleared, she saw, very large, in front of her eyes, N.K. A.W.A. She pulled back and saw Bango Skank awaits the king. It was the graffito written on the inside of the toilet stall's door. Her life was haunted by doors, had been, it seemed, ever since the door of her cell had clanged closed behind her in Oxford, Mississippi. But this one was shut. Good. She was coming to believe that shut doors presented fewer problems. Soon enough this one would open, and the problems would start again. Mia,
I told you all I know. Now, are you going to help me get to the Dixie Pig, or do I have to do it on my own? I can if I have to, especially with the turtle to help me.
Susanna, I'll help. Although how much or how little help Mia got from her sort of depended on what time it was right now. How long had they been in here? Her legs felt completely numb from the knees down, her butt too, and she thought that was a good sign, but under these fluorescent lights... Susanna supposed it was always half past any time.
"What does it matter to you?" Mia asked, suspicious. "What does it matter to you what time it is?"
Susanna scrambled for an explanation. "The baby. You know that what I did will keep it from coming only for so long, don't you?"
"Of course I do. That's why I want to get moving."
"All right, let's see the cash our old pal Matt's left us." Mia took out the little wad of bills and looked at them uncomprehendingly. "Take the one that says Jackson."
"I..."
"Embarrassment.
I can't read."
"Let me come forward. I'll read it."
"No."
All right, calm down. It's the guy with the long white hair combed back, kind of like Elvis."
"I don't know this Elvis."
"Never mind, it's that one right on top. Good, now put the rest of the cash back in your pocket, nice and safe. Hold the 20 in the palm of your hand. Okay, we're blowing this pop stand."
"What's a pop stand?"
"Mia,
shut up."
16. When they re-entered the lobby, walking slowly on legs that tingled with pins and needles, Susanna was marginally encouraged to see that it was dusk outside. She hadn't succeeded in burning up the entire day, it seemed, but she'd gotten rid of most of it. The lobby was busy but no longer frantic. The beautiful Eurasian girl who'd checked her, them, in was gone, her shift finished. Under the canopy, two new men in green monkey suits were whistling up cabs for folks, many of whom were wearing tuxedos or long, sparkly dresses.
"Going out to parties," Susanna said, "or maybe the theater."
"Susanna, I care not. Do we need to get one of the yellow vehicles from one of the men in the green suits?"
"No, we'll get a cab on the corner."
"Do you say so?"
"Oh, quit with the suspicion. You're taking your kid to either its death or yours, I'm sure of that, but I recognize your intention to do well, and I'll keep my promise.
Yes, I do say so."
"All right."
Without another word, certainly none of apology, Mia left the hotel, turned right, and began walking back toward 2nd Avenue, to Hammarskjöld Plaza, and the beautiful Song of the Rose. 17. On the corner of 2nd and 46th, a metal wagon of faded red was parked at the curb. The curb was yellow at this point, and a man in a blue suit, a guard with a watch by his sidearm, seemed to be discussing that fact with a tall, white-bearded man. Inside of her, Mia felt a flurry of startled movement.
"Susanna, what is it?"
"That man.
The guard of the watch, him?"
"No, the one with the beard. He looks almost exactly like Henchik. Henchik of the Mani, do you not see?" Mia neither saw nor cared. She gathered that although parking wagons along the yellow curb was forbidden, and the man with the beard seemed to understand this, he still would not move. He went on setting up easels and then putting pictures on them. Mia sensed this was an old argument between the two men.
"I'm going to have to give you a ticket, Rev."
"Do what you need to do, Officer Benzik. God loves you."
"Good. Delighted to hear it. As for the ticket, you'll tear it up, right?"
"Render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, render unto God those things that are God's. So says the Bible, and blessed be the Lord's holy book."
"I can get behind that," said Benzik of the watch.
He pulled a thick pad of paper from his back pocket and began to scribble on it. This also had the feel of an old ritual.
"But let me tell you something, Harrigan. Sooner or later, City Hall is going to catch up to your action, and they're going to render unto your scofflaw holy rolling ass. I only hope I'm there when it happens."
He tore a sheet from his pad, went over to the metal wagon, and slipped the paper beneath a black window slider resting on the wagon's glass front. Susanna, amused, "He's getting a ticket. Not the first one, either, from the sound." Mia, momentarily diverted in spite of herself,
"What does it say on the side of his wagon, Susanna?"
There was a slight shift as Susanna came part way forward and the sense of a squint. It was a strange sensation for Mia, like having a tickle deep in her head. Susanna, still sounding amused,
"It says, Church of the Holy God Bomb, Reverend Earl Harrigan. It also says your contributions will be rewarded in heaven."
"What's heaven?"
"Another name for the clearing at the end of the path."
"Ah." Benzik of the watch was strolling away with his hands clasped behind his back, his considerable ass bunching beneath his blue uniform trousers, his duty done. The Reverend Harrigan, meanwhile, was adjusting his easels. The picture on one showed a man being led out of jail by a fellow in a white robe. The white robe's head was glowing. The picture on the other showed the white robe turning away from a monster with red skin and horns on his head. The monster with the horns looked pissed like a bear at Cy White Robe.
"Susanna, is that red thing how the folk of this world see the Crimson King?"
"Susanna, I guess so. It's Satan, if you care, Lord of the Underworld. Have the God guy get you a cab, why don't you? Use the turtle." Again suspicious, Mia apparently couldn't help it.
"Do you say so? Say true, I say Jesus Christ, woman." "All right, all right."
Mia sounded a bit embarrassed. She walked toward Reverend Harrigan, pulling the scrimshaw turtle out of her pocket. 18. What she needed to do came to Susanna in a flash. She withdrew from Mia. If the woman couldn't get a taxi with the help of that magic turtle, she was hopeless. And with her eyes squeezed shut, visualized the Dogon. When she opened them, she was there. She grabbed the microphone she'd used to call Eddie and depressed the toggle. Harrigan, she said into the mic. Reverend Earl Harrigan, are you there? Do you read me, sugar? Do you read me?
19. Reverend Harrigan paused in his labors long enough to watch a black woman, one fine strutting honey too, praise God, get into a cab. The cab drove off. He had a lot to do before beginning his nightly sermon. His little dance with Officer Benzik was only the opening gun, but he stood there watching the cab's taillights twinkle and dwindle just the same. Had something just happened to him? Was it possible that... Reverend Harrigan fell to his knees on the sidewalk, quite oblivious of the pedestrians passing by, just as most were oblivious of him. He clasped his big old praise God hands and raised them to his chin. He knew the Bible said that praying was a private thing best done in one's closet, and he'd spent plenty of time getting knee-bound in his own, yes, Lord, but he also believed God wanted folks to see what a praying man looked like from time to time, because most of them, say God, had forgotten what that looked like. And there was no better, no nicer place to speak with God than right here on the corner of 2nd and 46th. There was a singing here, clean and sweet. It uplifted the spirit, clarified the mind, and just incidentally clarified the skin as well. This wasn't the voice of God, and Reverend Harrigan was not so blasphemously stupid as to think it was, but he had an idea that it was angels. Yes, say God bomb, the voice of the seraphim. God, did you just drop a little God bomb on me? I want to ask, was that voice I just heard yours or mine own? No answer. So many times there was no answer. He would ponder this. In the meantime, he had a sermon to prepare for. A show to do, if you wanted to be perfectly vulgar about it. Reverend Harrigan went to his van, parked at the yellow curb as always, and opened the back doors. Then he took out the pamphlets, the silk-covered collection plate which he'd put beside him on the sidewalk, and the sturdy wooden cube. The soapbox upon which he would stand, could you raise up high and shout hallelujah? And yes, brother, while you are right at it, could you give amen? Stave. Kamala, come, Ken. It's the other one again. You may know her name and face, but that don't make her your friend. Response. Kamala, come, Ten. She is not your friend. If you let her get too close, she'll cut you up again.
11th stanza. The writer. 1. By the time they reached the little shopping center in the town of Bridgeton, a supermarket, a laundry, and a surprisingly large drugstore, both Roland and Eddie sensed it. Not just the singing, but the gathering power. It lifted them up like some crazy, wonderful elevator. Eddie found himself thinking of Tinkerbell's magic dust and Dumbo's magic feather. This was like drawing near the rose, and yet not like that. There was no sense of holiness or sanctification in this little New England town, but something was going on here, and it was powerful. Driving here from East Stoneham, following the signs to Bridgeton from back road to back road, Eddie had sensed something else as well. The unbelievable crispness of this world. The summer green depths of the pine forests had a validity he had never encountered before, never even suspected. The birds which flew across the sky fair stopped his breath for wonder, even the most common sparrow. The very shadows on the ground seemed to have a velvety thickness, as if you could reach down, pick them up, and carry them away under your arm like pieces of carpet, if you so chose. At some point, Eddie asked Roland if he felt any of this.
Yes, Roland said. I feel it, see it, hear it. Eddie, I touch it.
Eddie nodded. He did too.
This world was real beyond reality. It was anti-Todash. That was the best he could do, and they were very much in the heart of the beam. Eddie could feel it carrying them on like a river rushing down a gorge toward a waterfall. But I'm afraid, Roland said. I feel as though we're approaching the center of everything. The tower itself, mayhap. It's as if, after all these years, the quest itself has become the point for me, and the end is frightening. Eddie nodded. He could get behind that. Certainly, he was afraid. If it wasn't the tower putting out that stupendous force, then it was some potent and terrible thing akin to the Rose, but not quite the same. A twin to the Rose? That could be right. Roland looked out at the parking lot and the people who came and went beneath a summer sky filled with fat, slow-floating clouds, seemingly unaware that the whole world was singing with power around them, and that all the clouds flowed along the same ancient pathway in the heavens. They were unaware of their own beauty. The gunslinger said, "I used to think the most terrible thing would be to reach the Dark Tower and find the top room empty. The god of all universes either dead or non-existent in the first place. But now, suppose there is someone there, Eddie. Someone in charge who turns out to be..." He couldn't finish. Eddie could.
"Someone who turns out to be just another bum hug? Is that it? God, not dead, but feeble-minded and malicious?"
Roland nodded. This was not, in fact, precisely what he was afraid of, but he thought Eddie had at least come close.
"How can that be, Roland, considering what we feel?"
Roland shrugged, as if to say anything could be.
"In any case, what choice do we have?"
"None," Roland said bleakly. "All things serve the beam." Whatever the great and singing force was, it seemed to be coming from the road that ran west from the shopping center back into the woods. Kansas Road, according to the sign, and that made Eddie think of Dorothy and Toto and Blaine the Mono. He dropped the transmission of their borrowed Ford into drive and started rolling forward. His heart was beating in his chest with slow, exclamatory force. He wondered if Moses had felt like this when he approached the burning bush which contained God. He wondered if Jacob had felt like this, awakening to find a stranger, both radiant and fair, in his camp, the angel with whom he would wrestle. He thought that they probably had. He felt sure that another part of their journey was about to come to an end. Another answer lay up ahead. God, living on Kansas Road in the town of Bridgeton, Maine? It should have sounded crazy, but didn't. "Just don't strike me dead," Eddie thought, and turned west. "I need to get back to my sweetheart. So please, don't strike me dead, whoever or whatever you are." "Man, I'm so scared," he said. Roland reached out and briefly grasped his hand. 2. 3 miles from the shopping center, they came to a dirt road which struck off into the pine trees on their left. There had been other byways, which Eddie had passed without slowing from the steady 30 miles an hour he had been maintaining, but at this one, he stopped. Both front windows were down. They could hear the wind in the trees, the grouchy call of a crow, the not-too-distant buzz of a powerboat, and the rumble of the Ford's engine. Except for 100,000 voices singing in rough harmony, those were the only sounds. The sign marking the turnoff said no more than "Private Drive." Nevertheless, Eddie was nodding.
"This is it."
"Yes, I know. How's your leg?"
"Hurts. Don't worry about it. Are we going to do this?"
"We have to," Roland said. "You were right to bring us here. What's here is the other half of this." He tapped the paper in his pocket, the one conveying ownership of the vacant lot to the Tet Corporation.
"You think this guy King is the Rose's twin?"
"You say true." Roland smiled at his own choice of words. Eddie thought he'd rarely seen one so sad. "We've picked up the collar way of talking, haven't we? Jake first, then all of us. But that will fall away."
"Further to go," Eddie said. It wasn't a question.
"Aye, and it will be dangerous. Still, maybe nothing so dangerous as this. Shall we roll?"
"In a minute. Roland, do you remember Susanna mentioning a man named Moses Carver?"
"A stem. Which is to say, a man of affairs. He took over her father's business when Cy Holmes died. Am I correct?"
"Yeah, he was also Sousa's godfather. She said he could be trusted completely. Remember how mad she got at Jake and me when we suggested he might have stolen the company's money?"
Roland nodded.
"I trust her judgment,"
Eddie said. What about you?
Yes.
If Carver is honest, we might be able to put him in charge of the things we need to accomplish in this world.
None of this seemed terribly important compared to the force Eddie felt rising all around him, but he thought it was. They might only have one chance to protect the Rose now and ensure its survival later. They had to do it right. And Eddie knew that meant heeding the will of destiny. In a word, Ka.
Suze says Holmes Dental was worth $8 or $10 million when you snatched her out of New York, Roland. If Carver's as good as I hope he is, the company might be worth $12 or $14 million by now.
That's a lot.
De la, Eddie said, tossing his open hand at the horizon, and Roland nodded. It sounds funny to talk about using the profits from some kind of dental process to save the universe, but that's just what I am talking about. And the money the Tooth Fairy left her may only be the beginning. Microsoft, for instance. Remember me mentioning that name to Tower?
Roland nodded. Slow down, Eddie. Calm down, I beg.
I'm sorry, Eddie said, and pulled in a deep breath. It's this place. The singing. The faces. Do you see the faces in the trees? In the shadows?
I see them very well.
It makes me feel a little crazy. Bear with me. What I'm talking about is merging Holmes Dental and the Tet Corporation, then using our knowledge of the future to turn it into one of the richest combinations in the history of the world. Resources to equal those of the Sombra Corporation, or maybe North Central Positronics itself.
Roland shrugged, then lifted a hand as if to ask how Eddie could talk about money while in the presence of the immense force flowing along the barrel of the beam and through them, lifting the hair from the napes of their necks, making their sinuses tingle, turning every woodsy shadow into a watching face, as if a multitude had gathered here to watch them play out a crucial scene in their drama.
I know how you feel, but it matters, Eddie insisted. Believe me, it does. Suppose, for instance, we were to grow fast enough to buy out North Central Positronics before it can rise as a force in this world. Roland, we might be able to turn it the way you can turn even the biggest river with no more than a single spade up in its headwaters, where it's only a trickle.
At this, Roland's eyes gleamed. Take it over, he said. Turn its purpose from the Crimson Kings to our own. Yes, that might be possible.
Whether it is or isn't, we have to remember that we're not just playing for 1977 or 1987, where I came from, or 1999, where Suze went.
In that world, Eddie realized, Calvin Tower might be dead, and Aaron Deepnow would be for sure their final action in the Dark Towers drama, saving Donald Callahan from the Hitler brothers, long finished. Swept from the stage, both of them, into the clearing at the end of the path, along with Gasher and Hoots, Benny Sleitman, Susan Delgado,
Kala Callahan, Susan, Susanna, and the TikTok man, even Blaine and Patricia. Roland and his quartet would also pass into that clearing, be it early or late. In the end, if they were fantastically lucky and suicidally brave, only the Dark Tower would stand. If they could nip North Central Positronics in the bud, they might be able to save all the beams that had been broken. Even if they failed at that, two beams might be enough to hold the tower in place. The Rose in New York, and a man named Stephen King in Maine. Eddie's head had no proof that this was indeed the case, but his heart believed it. What we're playing for, Roland, is the ages.
Roland made a fist and thumped it lightly on the dusty dashboard of John Cullum's old Ford and nodded.
Anything can go on that lot, you realize that? Anything. A building, a park, a monument, the National Gramophone Institute, as long as the Rose stays. This guy Carver can make the Tet Corporation legal, maybe working with Aaron Deepnow.
Yes, Roland said. I liked Deepnow. He had a true face.
Eddie thought so, too. Anyway, they can draw up legal papers that take care of the Rose. The Rose always stays, no matter what. And I've got a feeling that it will. 2007? 2057? 2525? 3700? Hell, the year 19,000. I think it'll always be there, because it may be fragile, but I think it's also immortal.
We have to do it right while we have the chance, though, because this is the key world. In this one, you never get a chance to whittle a little more if the key doesn't turn. In this world, I don't think there are any do-overs.
Roland considered this, then pointed to the dirt road leading into the trees, into a forest of watching faces and singing voices, a harmonium of all that filled life with worth and meaning, that held to the truth, that acknowledged the white.
And what about the man who lives at the end of this road, Eddie? If he is a man.
I think he is. And not just because of what John Cullum said. It's what I feel here.
Eddie patted his chest above the heart.
So do I.
Do you say so, Roland?
I do. Is he immortal, do you think? Because I've seen much in my years and heard rumors of much more, but never of a man or woman who lived forever.
I don't think he needs to be immortal. I think all he needs to do is write the right story, because some stories do live forever.
Understanding lit up Roland's eyes. At last, Eddie thought. At last, he sees it. But how long had it taken him to see it himself and then to swallow it? God knew he should have been able to, after all the other wonders he'd seen, and yet still this last step had eluded him. Even discovering that Per Callahan had seemingly sprung alive and breathing from a fiction called Salem's Lot hadn't been enough to take him that last crucial step. What had finally done it was finding out that Co-op City was in the Bronx, not Brooklyn, in this world at least, which was the only world that mattered.
Maybe he's not at home, Roland said, as around them the whole world waited. Maybe this man who made us is not at home.
You know he is.
Roland nodded, and the old light had dawned in his eyes, light from a fire that had never gone out, the one that had lit his way along the beam all the way from Gilead.
Then drive on, he cried hoarsely. Drive on for your father's sake. If he's God, our God, I'd look him in the eye and ask him the way to the tower.
Would you not ask him the way to Susanna first?
As soon as the question was out of his mouth, Eddie regretted it and prayed the gunslinger would not answer it. Roland didn't. He only twirled the remaining fingers on his right hand. Go, go. Eddie put the gear shift of Cullum's Ford into drive and turned onto the dirt road. He drove them into a great singing force that seemed to go through them like a wind, turning them into something as insubstantial as a thought or a dream in the head of some sleeping god. 3. A quarter of a mile in, the road forked. Eddie took the left-hand branch, although the sign pointing that way said Roden, not King. The dust raised by their passage hung in the rearview mirror. The singing was a sweet din, pouring through him like liquor. His hair was still standing up at the roots, and his muscles were trembling. Called upon to draw his gun, Eddie thought he would probably drop the damn thing. Even if he managed to hold on to it, aiming would be impossible. He didn't know how the man they were looking for could live so close to the sound of that singing and eat or sleep, let alone write stories. But of course King wasn't just close to the sound. If Eddie had it right, King was the source of the sound. But if he has a family, what about them? And even if he doesn't, what about the neighbors? Here was a driveway on the right, and
Eddie, stop.
It was Roland, but not sounding the least bit like himself. His collar tan was thin paint over an immense pallor. Eddie stopped. Roland fumbled at the door handle on his side, couldn't make it work, levered himself out the window all the way to his waist instead. Eddie heard the chink his belt buckle made on the chrome strip which faced the window well, and then vomited onto the organ. When he fell back into the seat, he looked both exhausted and exalted. The eyes which rolled to meet Eddie's were blue, ancient, glittering.
Drive on.
Roland, are you sure?
Roland only twirled his fingers, looking straight out through the Ford's dusty windshield.
Go, go, for your father's sake.
Eddie drove on. 4. It was the sort of house real estate agents call a ranch. Eddie wasn't surprised. What did surprise him a little was how modest the place was. Then he reminded himself that not every writer was a rich writer, and that probably went double for young writers. Some sort of typo had apparently made his second novel quite the catch among bibliomaniacs, but Eddie doubted if King ever saw a commission on that sort of thing, or royalties, if that was what they called it. Still, the car parked in the turnaround driveway was a new-looking Jeep Cherokee, with a nifty Indian stripe running up the side, and that suggested Stephen King wasn't exactly starving for his art, either. There was a wooden jungle gym in the front yard with a lot of plastic toys scattered around it. Eddie's heart sank at the sight of them. One lesson which the color had taught exquisitely was that kids complicated things. The ones living here were little kids, from the look of the toys. And to them comes a pair of men wearing hard calibers, men who were not at this point in time strictly in their right minds. Eddie cut the Ford's engine. A crow cawed. A powerboat, bigger than the one they'd heard earlier from the sound, buzzed. Beyond the house, bright sun glinted on blue water. And the voices sang, "Come, come, 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 Kamala." There was a clunk as Roland opened his door and got out, slewing a little as he did so. Bad hip, dry twist. Eddie got out on legs that felt as numb as sticks.
"Tabby, that you?"
This from around the right side of the house. And now, running ahead of the voice and the man who owned the voice, came a shadow. Never had Eddie seen one that so filled him with terror and fascination. He thought, and with absolute certainty, "Yonder comes my maker. Yonder is he, I say true." And the voices sang, "Kamala, come three, he who made me."
"Did you forget something, darling?"
Only the last word came out in a down-east drawl, the way John Cullum would have said it. And then came the man of the house. Then came he. He saw them and stopped. He saw Roland and stopped. The singing voices stopped with him, and the powerboat's drone seemed to stop as well. For a moment, the whole world hung on a hinge. Then the man turned and ran. Not, however, before Eddie saw the terrible, thunderstruck look of recognition on his face. Roland was after him in a flash, like a cat after a bird. 5. But Cy King was a man, not a bird. He couldn't fly, and there was really nowhere to run. The side lawn sloped down a mild hill, broken only by a concrete pad that might have been the well or some kind of sewage pumping device. Beyond the lawn was a postage-stamp-sized bit of beach littered with more toys. After that came the lake. The man reached the edge of it, splashed into it, then turned so awkwardly he almost fell down. Roland skidded to a stop on the sand. He and Stephen King regarded each other. Eddie stood perhaps 10 yards behind Roland, watching both of them. The singing had begun again, and so had the buzzing drone of the powerboat. Perhaps they had never stopped. But Eddie believed he knew better. The man in the water put his hands over his eyes like a child. "You're not there," he said. "I am, Cy." Roland's voice was both gentle and filled with awe. "Take your hands from your eyes, Stephen of Bridgeton. Take them down and see me very well."
"Maybe I'm having a breakdown," said the man in the water, but he slowly dropped his hands.
He was wearing thick glasses with severe black frames. One bow had been mended with a bit of tape. His hair was either black or a very dark brown. The beard was definitely black, the first threads of white in it startling in their brilliance. He was wearing blue jeans below a T-shirt that said "The Ramones" and "Rocket to Russia" and "Gabba Gabba Hey." He looked like starting to run to middle-aged fat, but he wasn't fat yet. He was tall and as ashy pale as Roland. Eddie saw with no real surprise that Stephen King looked like Roland. Given the age difference, they could never be mistaken for twins, but father and son? Yes, easily. Roland tapped the base of his throat 3 times, then shook his head. It wasn't enough. It wouldn't do.
Eddie watched with fascination and horror as the gunslinger sank to his knees amid the litter of bright plastic toys and put his curled hand against his brow.
"Heil, Tailspinner," he said, "comes to you, Roland Deschain of Gilead that was, and Eddie Dean of New York. Will you open to us if we open to you?" King laughed. Given the power of Roland's words, Eddie found the sound shocking.
Man, this can't be happening. And then to himself, can it?
Roland, still on his knees, went on as if the man standing in the water had neither laughed nor spoken. "Do you see us for what we are, and what we do?"
"You'd be gunslingers if you were real." King peered at Roland through his thick spectacles. "Gunslingers seeking the Dark Tower."
"That's it," Eddie thought as the voices rose and the sun shimmered on the blue water. "That nails it." "You say true, Sai. We seek aid and succor. Stephen of Bridgeton, will ye give it?"
"Mister, I don't know who your friend is, but as for you, man, I made you. You can't be standing there because the only place you really exist is here."
He thumped a fist to the center of his forehead as if in parody of Roland. Then he pointed to his house, his ranch-style house. "And in there, you're in there too, I guess, in a desk drawer or maybe a box in the garage. Your unfinished business, I haven't thought of you in...
His voice had grown thin. Now he began to sway like someone who hears faint but delicious music, and his knees buckled. He fell.
"Roland!" Eddie shouted, at last plunging forward. "Man's had a fucking heart attack!"
Already knowing, or perhaps only hoping, better, because the singing was as strong as ever, the faces in the trees and shadows as clear. The gunslinger was bending down and grasping King, who had already begun to thrash weakly, under the arms. "He's but fainted, and who could blame him? Help me get him into the house."
6.
The master bedroom had a gorgeous view of the lake and a hideous purple rug on the floor. Eddie sat on the bed and watched through the bathroom door as King took off his wet sneakers and outer clothes, stepping between the door and the tiled bathroom wall for a moment to swap his wet undershorts for a dry pair. He hadn't objected to Eddie following him into the bedroom since coming to, and he'd been out for no more than 30 seconds. He had displayed an almost eerie calm. Now he came out of the bathroom and crossed to the bureau. "Is this a practical joke?" he asked, rummaging for dry jeans and a fresh T-shirt. To Eddie, King's house said money, some at least. God knew what the clothes said. "Is it something Mac McCutcheon and Floyd Calderwood dreamed up? I don't know those men, and it's no joke." "Maybe not, but that man can't be real." King stepped into the jeans. He spoke to Eddie in a reasonable tone of voice. "I mean, I wrote about him." Eddie nodded. "I kind of figured that. But he's real just the same. I've been running with him for..." How long, Eddie didn't know. "For a while," he finished. "You wrote about him, but not me? Do you feel left out?" Eddie laughed, but in truth he did feel left out. A little, anyway. Maybe King hadn't gotten to him yet. If that was the case, he wasn't exactly safe, was he? "This doesn't feel like a breakdown," King said. "But I suppose they never do."
"You're not having a breakdown, but I have some sympathy for how you feel, Sai. That man..."
"Roland. Roland of Gilead?"
"You say true."
"I don't know if I had the Gilead part or not," King said. "I'd have to check the pages, if I could find them. But it's good, as in, there is no bomb in Gilead?
I'm not following you."
"That's okay. Neither am I." King found cigarettes, Pall Malls, on the bureau and lit one. "Finish what you were going to say."
"He dragged me through a door between this world and his world. I also felt like I was having a breakdown."
It hadn't been this world from which Eddie had been dragged, close but no cigar, and he'd been jonesing for heroin at the time, jonesing big time, but the situation was complicated enough without adding that stuff. Still, there was one question he had to ask before they rejoined Roland and the real palaver began.
"Tell me something, Cy King.
Do you know where Co-op City is?
King had been transferring his coins and keys from his wet jeans to the dry ones, right eye squinted shut against the smoke of the cigarette tucked in the corner of his mouth. Now he stopped and looked at Eddie with his eyebrows raised.
Is this a trick question?
No.
And you won't shoot me with that gun you're wearing if I get it wrong?
Eddie smiled a little. King wasn't an unlikable cuss for a god. Then he reminded himself that God had killed his little sister, using a drunk driver as a tool, and his brother Henry as well. God had made Enrico Balazar and burned Susan Delgado at the stake. His smile faded, but he said,
"No one's getting shot here, Cy."
"In that case, I believe Co-op City's in Brooklyn, where you come from, judging by your accent. So do I win the fair day goose?" Eddie jerked like someone who's been poked with a pin.
"What?"
"Just a thing my mother used to say when my brother Dave and I did all our chores and got 'em right the first time. She'd say, 'You boys win the fair day goose.' It was a joke."
"So do I win the prize?"
"Yes," Eddie said. "Sure." King nodded, then butted out his cigarette. "You're an okay guy. It's your pal I don't much care for, and never did. I think that's part of the reason I quit on the story." That startled Eddie again, and he got up from the bed to cover it.
"Quit on it?"
"Yeah, the Dark Tower, it was called. It was gonna be my Lord of the Rings, my Gormenghast, my you name it. One thing about being 22 is that you're never short of ambition. It didn't take me long to see that it was just too big for my little brain. Too, I don't know, outre? That's as good a word as any, I guess. Also," he added dryly, "I lost the outline."
"You did what?"
"Sounds crazy, doesn't it? But writing can be a crazy deal. Did you know that Ernest Hemingway once lost a whole book of short stories on a train?"
"Really?"
"Really. He had no backup copies, no carbons. Just poof, gone. That's sort of what happened to me. One fine, drunk night, or maybe I was done up on mescaline, I can no longer remember, I did a complete outline for this 5 or 10,000-page fantasy epic. It was a good outline, I think. Gave the thing some form, some style, and then I lost it. Probably flew off the back of my motorcycle when I was coming back from some fucking bar. Nothing like that ever happened to me before. I'm usually careful about my work, if nothing else."
"Uh-huh,"
Eddie said, and thought of asking, "Did you happen to see any guys in loud clothes, the sort of guys who drive flashy cars, around the time you lost it? Low men, not to put too fine a point on it? Anyone with a red mark on his or her forehead? The sort of thing that looks a little like a circle of blood? Any indications, in short, that someone stole your outline? Someone who might have an interest in making sure the Dark Tower never gets finished?
Let's go out to the kitchen. We need to palaver."
Eddie just wished he knew what they were supposed to palaver about. Whatever it was, they had better get it right, because this was the real world. The one in which there were no do-overs. 7. Roland had no idea of how to stock and then start the fancy coffee maker on the counter, but he found a battered coffee pot on one of the shelves that was not much different from the one Alan Johns had carried in his gunner long ago, when three boys had come to Major's to count stock. Cy King's stove ran on electricity, but a child could have figured out how to make the burners work. When Eddie and King came into the kitchen, the pot was beginning to get hot. "I don't use coffee myself," King said, and went to the cold box, giving Roland a wide berth. "And I don't ordinarily drink beer before 5, but I believe that today I'll make an exception. Mr. Dean? Coffee will do me fine. Mr. Gilead?"
"It's Duchesne, Cy King. I'll also have the coffee, and say thank you."
The writer opened a can by using the built-in ring in the top, a device that struck Roland as superficially clever and almost moronically wasteful. There was a hiss, followed by the pleasant smell, Kamala cum cum, of yeast and hops. King drank down at least half the can at a go, wiped foam out of his mustache, and put the can on the counter.
He was still pale, but seemingly composed and in possession of his faculties. The gunslinger thought he was doing quite well, at least so far. Was it possible that, in some of the deeper ranges of his mind and heart, King had expected their visit? Had been waiting for them?
"You have a wife and children," Roland said. "Where are they?"
"Tabby's folks live up north near Bangor. My daughter's been spending the last week with her Nana and Papa. Tabby took our youngest, Owen, he's just a baby, and headed that way about an hour ago. I'm supposed to pick up my other son, Joe, in..." He checked his watch. "In just about an hour. I wanted to finish my writing, so this time we're taking both cars."
Roland considered. It might be true. It was almost certainly King's way of telling them that if anything happened to him, he would be missed in short order.
"I can't believe this is happening. Have I said that enough to be annoying yet? In any case, it's too much like one of my own stories to be happening. Like Salem's Lot, for instance," Eddie suggested.
King raised his eyebrows.
"So you know about that. Do they have a literary guild wherever you came from?" He downed the rest of his beer. He drank, Roland thought, like a man with a gift for it. "A couple of hours ago, there were sirens way over on the other side of the lake, plus a big plume of smoke. I could see it from my office. At the time, I thought it was probably just a grass fire, maybe in Harrison or Stoneham, but now, I wonder, did that have anything to do with you guys?"
"It did, didn't it?"
Eddie said, "He's writing it, Roland. Or was. He says he stopped. But it's called The Dark Tower. So he knows."
King smiled, but Roland thought he looked really deeply frightened for the first time. Setting aside that initial moment when he'd come around the corner of the house and seen them, that was, when he'd seen his creation. "Is that what I am? His creation?"
It felt wrong and right in equal measure. Thinking about it made Roland's head ache and his stomach feel slippery all over again.
"He knows," King said. "I don't like the sound of that, boys. In a story, when someone says he knows, the next line is usually, 'We'll have to kill him.'"
"Believe me when I tell you this," Roland said. He spoke with great emphasis. "Killing you is the last thing we'd ever want to do, Psy King. Your enemies are our enemies, and those who would help you along your way are our friends."
"Amen," Eddie said.
King opened his cold box and got another beer. Roland saw a great many of them in there, standing to frosty attention. More cans of beer than anything else.
"In that case," he said, "you better call me Steve."
8.
"Tell us the story with me in it," Roland invited.
King leaned against the kitchen counter, and the top of his head caught a shaft of sun. He took a sip of his beer and considered Roland's question. Eddie saw it then for the first time, very dim, a contrast to the sun perhaps, a dusty, black shadow. Something swaddled around the man, dim, barely there, but there. Like the darkness you saw hiding behind things when you traveled Todash.
Was that it?
Eddie didn't think so.
Barely there, but there.
"You know," King said, "I'm not much good at telling stories. That sounds like a paradox, but it's not. It's the reason I write them down."
"Is it Roland he talks like, or me?" Eddie wondered. He couldn't tell. Much later on, he'd realized that King talked like all of them. Even Rosa Munoz, Per Callahan's woman of work in the Cala. Then the writer brightened.
"Tell you what, why don't I see if I can find the manuscript? I've got 4 or 5 boxes of busted stories downstairs. Dark Tower's gotta be in one of them."
Busted. Busted stories. Eddie didn't care for the sound of that at all.
"You can read some of it while I go get my little boy."
He grinned, displaying big, crooked teeth.
"Maybe when I get back, you'll be gone, and I can get to work on thinking you were never here at all."
Eddie glanced at Roland, who shook his head slightly. On the stove, the first bubble of coffee blinked in the pot's glass eye.
"Psy King," Eddie began.
"Steve,
Steve, then. We ought to transact our business now. Matters of trust aside, we're in a ripping hurry.
Sure, sure, right. Racing against time, King said, and laughed. The sound was charmingly goofy. Eddie suspected that the beer was starting to do its work, and he wondered if the man was maybe a juice head. Impossible to tell for sure on such short acquaintance, but Eddie thought some of the signs were there. He didn't remember a whole hell of a lot from high school English, but he did recall some teacher or other telling him that writers really liked to drink. Hemingway, Faulkner, Fitzgerald, the Raven guy. Writers liked to drink.
I'm not laughing at you guys, King said. It's actually against my religion to laugh at men who are toting guns. It's just that in the sort of books I write, people are almost always racing against time. Would you like to hear the first line of The Dark Tower?
Sure, if you remember it, Eddie said.
Roland said nothing, but his eyes gleamed bright under brows that were now threaded with white.
Oh, I remember it. It may be the best opening line I ever wrote.
King set his beer aside, then raised his hands with the first two fingers of each held out and bent, as if making quotation marks.
The man in black fled across the desert, and the gunslinger followed. The rest might have been puff and blow, but man, that was clean.
He dropped his hands and picked up his beer. For the 43rd time, is this really happening?
Was the man in black's name Walter?
Roland asked. King's beer tilted shy of his mouth, and he spilled some down his front, wetting his fresh shirt. Roland nodded, as if that was all the answer he needed.
Don't faint on us again, Eddie said, a trifle sharply. Once was enough to impress me.
King nodded, took another sip of his beer, seemed to take hold of himself at the same time. He glanced at the clock.
Are you gentlemen really going to let me pick up my son?
Yes, Roland said.
You, King paused to consider, then smiled. Do you set your watch and your warrant on it?
With no smile in return, Roland said, so I do.
Okay, then. The Dark Tower. Reader's Digest condensed book version. Keeping in mind that oral storytelling isn't my thing, I'll do the best I can.
9. Roland listened, as if worlds depended on it, as he was quite sure they did. King had begun his version of Roland's life with the campfires, which had pleased the gunslinger because they confirmed Walter's essential humanity. From there, King said, the story went back to Roland's meeting with a kind of shirt-tail farmer on the edge of the desert. Brown, his name had been. Life for your crop, Roland heard across an echo of years, and life for your own. He'd forgotten Brown, and Brown's pet raven, Zoltan, but this stranger had not.
What I liked, King said, was how the story seemed to be going backward. From a purely technical standpoint, it was very interesting. I start with you in the desert, then slip back a notch to you meeting Brown and Zoltan. Zoltan was named after a folk singer and guitarist I knew at the University of Maine, by the way. Anyway, from the dweller's hut, the story slips back another notch to you coming into the town of Tull. Named after a rock group.
Jethro Tull, Eddie said.
God damn, of course. I knew that name was familiar. What about ZZ Top, Steve? Do you know them?
Eddie looked at King, saw the incomprehension, and smiled.
I guess it's not their when, quite yet, or if it is, you haven't found out about them.
Roland twirled his fingers, go on, go on, and gave Eddie a look that suggested he stop interrupting.
Anyway, from Roland coming into Tull, the story slips back another notch to tell how Nort, the weed eater, died and was resurrected by Walter. You see what buzzed me about it, don't you? The early part of it was all told in reverse gear. It was bass ackwards.